Maybe what I can do this morning, since I'm going to give the class this afternoon on things about community, that this morning I could share some stories about Bhaktisiddhanta Srila Prabhupada in connection with what we'd like to discuss this morning. I think it will help the discussion be more wholesome. There's so many powerful examples of our acharyas, of how they help us to understand that our existence in Sadhu Sangha Association is really practice. We're practicing now in community and association how to prepare for our eternal associations in the spiritual world. It's just that simple and that difficult. Just like if you're practicing as a musician, you're practicing as a sportsman. So according to the quality of your practice, it determines the quality of your performance. One cannot expect to be very whimsical in their practice and have some high level of achievement when it really comes down to the chance to perform. Because what we do each moment, each day, determines who we are, what we are, what our quality is, and whatever that we're doing. So sometimes as devotees, we have a tendency of looking at the long-term goals, which is very important. But we must realize that long-term goal, acquiring it, has to do with how we're acquiring short-term goals, what we're doing in the interim, what we're doing in our day-to-day exchanges. But sometimes we see that devotees can be very, very devotional when it comes to serving their spiritual master, hopefully, and then have no regard for anyone else. And this is, of course, not guru worship. This is hero worship. This is fanaticism. Because really, just as we know, we cannot just directly worship Krishna. We don't just jump over everything else, sadhu, shastra, and so on, and feel that somehow we can connect with Krishna. We connect with Krishna through the way that he has made available. And he has made available through the shastra, through the spiritual scriptures where we find out about him and how to grow up through his gratification. And through the association with sadhus, we have chance to practice what we read in the scriptures. So what actually happens is, of course, is the quality of our sadhu association determines the real quality of our guru association. And the quality of our guru association determines how much we are learning properly to be able to serve Krishna and to be in our original sarvup in bona fide, totally authentic community in the spiritual world. So, not that somehow we go back to Krishna and we've been weak in our sadhana. He said last night we've been engaged in aparaj, offenses and things of those different types. And somehow we just go with that and go back now. We go back because what? Because we become like the residents of the spiritual world. Therefore we have to study them closely and see what they do. We get a glimpse of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, because such residents come into this world, like you're reading the Bhagavatam about Krishna's incarnations, and I think non-cessation, different things. So, as we look at why Krishna comes, you realize he comes to help to make it easier for us to be aware of his love, to make it easier for us to work in sense of unity, in trying to become freed of sense gratification and to redirect those energies into something higher. So we really should be very careful in how we really take the importance of association. The associations that we have somehow been arranged based on what each of us are carrying as part of our home battle or food section. In other words, our difficulties, our challenges, whatever they may be, in my words, is part of what is necessary for each individual to be able to go back to the spiritual world. And so, if our challenge is that we are sickly, if our challenge is that we are poor, if our challenge is that we are wealthy, if our challenge is that we have good children, our challenge is that we have a good health, our challenge is that we have difficulty, this or that, then so many of those things is part of the field of activity that Krishna is watching, how we're still going to say yes to Him, in spite of whatever those challenges we are going to be. We can't kind of think, well, I could really be a better devotee if I just said, well, no, this is what, this may be what wants in the situation in this lifetime. Or I could be so much more of a better devotee if I was serving another part of the world, if I was in a different gender. We have come in a particular situation for the fact that this is what is necessary, this is part of our test, this is part of our own individual battle, who is such. So then we engage in such struggle in association. How hard it becomes if someone is trying to struggle and the environment itself is not supportive. Forms and regulations that we're following are also anti-material, so much against the normative patterns of living in this world. And that can become very difficult if we're trying to do such things, and we're going against the basic culture of mature society. We're going against, in most cases, our backgrounds, our tradition, etc. And so, to try to go on every day and to have an environment that is not exhilarating, that is not motivating, that is not very conducive, is almost a given failure. We know Shatruhava Jamti Mahagama Sukhati. We know that Shatru, the four types of people they come. And of those four types, only one type is out of knowledge, which is a minority. So someone is coming to say yes to Krishna, someone is saying yes to transcendence, based on the fact that their life has had a significant amount of anxiety. They're coming due to such disgust and anxiety and problems. In some cases, it's due to economic considerations and problems. Someone is coming due to some major issues concerning finance. Someone is else because of curiosity, but they're pious. They could be curious about other things, they're curious about what's spiritual, they're not of knowledge. Now, somebody's coming out of stress, somebody's coming for wealth, somebody's coming out of curiosity. Those three categories, which are the majority, will distinctly be highly, highly influenced based on the quality of the caliber of the community. Those who come in knowledge will also be influenced, but less disturbed because they are a little more fixed and deeper understanding. So they have more strength to kind of weather whatever the challenges in the community are. But that's kind of rare. Even those who often profess that they're Brahmins, still in many cases, their coming to Krishna wasn't really so much a pursuit of knowledge mainly, but also curiosity, inquisitiveness, speculation, investigation due to some problems of distress, etc. So we see many people join, but most people leave. We look at the thousands of people who come to our association, majority of them stay. Some will stay for some years. They come at first very enthusiastic. Different things happen to them. Go through different cycles, etc. But a whole lot, and that's it. A lot they leave, but they don't really leave. They just leave maybe being actively involved. But still, they have strong alignment or affiliation with Krishna consciousness in terms of really wanting to be, you know, to be a better devotee. But huge number, actually. So we'll look this afternoon, later this morning, some interactive discussion trying to see how we can become stronger ourselves as devotees, how we can have stronger families, and how we can have stronger projects and ultimately in a stronger society. We'll brush upon a few basic simple things to address these areas. But I want to share one or two stories. This is the Bhagavatam period. One or two stories is a way to help us to reflect a little more through the course of the day. Maximize our little time together. Because it is a serious issue in our society. Our society is in a crisis. In fact, the whole world is in a crisis now. The whole world is in a crisis in many ways. We know economic problems, we know political problems, we know disease issues. But there's a real problem about God. Because there's so much fanaticism now. Created terrorism, is about to create wars, etc. on all sides. So, for many people, they're even questioning the validity of God. Everybody's religion is on trial, and for many cases, God is on trial. For a lot of people, for millions of people. They're seeing there's so many people who profess to be religious, really, really religious, who are really stuck in their home, you know, religion. In a myopic or narrow-minded way, are some of the most dangerous people on the planet. Because religious fanatics can justify all kinds of inhumanities to humankind and say that it is, you know, they are inspired to, you know, by divine. Again, something very powerful, use rights to do wonderful things, but not to be the most destructive. So Krishna consciousness, it also fits into the category. And that Krishna consciousness gives us powerful, intimate knowledge about the soul, about the spiritual world, about Krishna. There's so much powerful spiritual technology in how to develop the most mature nature. But it is also one of the most dangerous kind of philosophies on the planet. Vedic culture is the most liberating because it is very spiritually scientific. There's no culture more dangerous when it's abused. When Vedic culture is abused in community, it creates what? It creates tyrants, leaders who cannot accept feedback, who are not sensitive to the implications, ramifications of their activities. Autocrats, tyrants are like that. They have something they want to do, and they do it and force it on people. And care very little about the people, but just concerned about what they want to do. Vedic culture misused can create casteism, where it brings all kind of unhealthy, you know, stratification. This is what it produced, you know, smarter Brahmins. This is what it produced a lot of people, for instance, in India, who are in the lower, so-called lower class, who now have become involved in Islam because of those exploiting Vedic culture. Not giving them facilitation, and therefore they look for some support system, some community, they feel welcome, and therefore they go outside. If they're labeled as suitors in the sense of being treated in an offensive way, not being able to be given necessary things for survival, then naturally someone will go where they feel they're valued, where they can be cared for, etc., where they're feeling that they have some sense of purpose, some sense of appreciation. And why also many people in Bharatvarsa are taken to Christianity in some cases. Also, Vedic culture, when it is exploited in community, it creates chauvinism, where women are treated as second class under the banner of so-called Vedic etiquette. Yes, there is definitely etiquette that is distinct. Whenever there's culture, there's a distinct etiquette of how to do things and how to associate. And Vedic culture emphasizes the protection of women and children. And that can be abused in the sense of instead of being given protection, it can be the dominance that minimizes the actual thing that's supposed to happen. Caring and providing exploitation, manipulation, etc. And Vedic culture can create racism, classism, chauvinism, autocratic, etc. excessive autocracy that brings terror. So all of these things are so easy to happen in abuse and misuse of Vedic culture. And does happen. And leadership has to particularly take extra notice to make sure that such things do not take place. Because in Kali Yuga, they're more likely to, you know, than not. So some of these things, they have their way of surfacing and fracturing, but it can be very sweet and community, which really is designed to help us to become a resident of the spiritual world, but it can, Maya can trick us and cause us still acting so much like the entities in the material world. Now I want to give one or two stories, help us a little closer at the importance of each devotee and community. See, one of the dangers also of institutions, the institutions are extremely important because institutions are designed to help people to be accountable. They're designed to remind us about what we're supposed to be about. They're designed to help us to evaluate ourselves and others. So without institutions, there's anarchy, there's a lack of consolidation, lack of focus. But again, institutions also can be extremely dangerous. Because institutions, whether they are spiritual, whether they are commercial, whether they are political or educational, institutions have a frightening way of, while dealing with the many, they have a way of minimizing the one. While pursuing certain goals, it has a tendency of also justifying how the means can justify the end. And sometimes in that pursuance, the end gets more and more in the background, and the means become everything. But then again, the end results get lost. So anybody's institution, sometimes we are thinking that it cannot happen in our own institution, but it's a transcendental institution. No. There's certain things that are just common to institutions and communities that, just historically speaking, can happen and can surface. It doesn't matter what type of institution it is, because it's based on certain gatherings and certain maturations and evolutions and exploitations. So therefore, because this is likely to happen, then again, people have to be very careful to make sure that while trying to attain certain goals, we're not jeopardizing our essence or our principles. While trying to create great projects and many wonderful things happening, that we're not minimizing the care of each devotee. And as we do such things, we have to constantly remind ourselves that our real activity is the care and the progress and the devotion of each person. We create an environment that brings the greatest kind of enthusiasm and greatest direction to as many people as possible. So, two stories I want to share. One is in connection with, you know, with Bhaktisiddhanta. Bhaktisiddhanta had sent a few devotees, or special disciples, to do some preaching, and I think it's West Bengal, and to also build a temple. So they worked very, very hard. It wasn't so easy, because, you know, finances are not so much available. Trying to get people away from Sahajism and excessive worship and Devas and so many other things. But these group of devotees, they worked really hard and finally they were successful. So they called their Guru Maharaj to come to bless the project, to see what they have done, what they did. Now something happened just a few days before the opening of the temple. One of the brahmacharis who had joined the group to help with the preaching, he got somewhat entangled. And it was definitely improper. His association was becoming too familiar with one of the ladies in the community. extended community. So, the devotees called him out very heavily, to such an extent that he became just totally overwhelmed. And like sometimes devotees do in the middle of the night, they pack their gear and they disappear. At morning time, there was no one in sight. It blew. The devotees went around looking for him. They couldn't find him. So they had to get ready, you know, for the Guru Maharaj was coming. And so Bodhisattva came. He opened the temple and they saw the beautiful project that was going on. He knew how hard the devotees had struggled. And he was very, very happy. See that they had created, you know, for this mandir. People come and have darshan. Bodhis had a place where they could, you know, gather and associate. They had a place where they could be more in community, just with, you know, their devotional life, devotional people. But as he began to take notice of his disciples, he noticed that this Brahmachari was not a monk. And of course he inquired about this devotee. And so the devotees explained how this devotee, you know, had blue. And just as happy as Bodhisattva was about the project, he became that much intensely discouraged and remorseful. And he began to explain how much blood it takes, how much work and how much dedication to make a devotee. And he explained how the devotees were more important than the rooms and the bricks and the temple. And they began to understand a little better that the idea of the temple was for changing consciousness, reclaiming souls and keeping souls or devotees together to be able to go on progressively in their devotion. So it's almost like a contradiction that they are creating an atmosphere to make people devotees. At the same time, they were losing their soldiers. So the devotees were, you know, they were bewildered. The Guru Maharaj was not so disappointed. It brought down the whole, you know, time, the excitement about the temple. So they realized that they had to do something. And the main thing was how, somehow, to find this devotee. So they had tried it earlier, but they couldn't. But then one of them remembered that at one time, one of the residents had broken his watch. And this devotee had taken the watch and repaired it. So like normally what happens, often when someone loops, they go back to their previous lifestyle. They go back to the previous connection. So they suspected this devotee has some skill of being, you know, watch repairman. And that maybe, very likely perhaps, he had pursued in the material world a profession, a way of raising finance, fixing watches. So they started going around to the watch shops. And lo and behold, one shop, they described who they were looking for, and the owner. And he said, yeah, he's in the back there, doing his work, been working for a while. So then these devotees, they were overwhelmed, knowing how much Guru Maharaj wanted to see them all together and how much he felt they should be able to protect, work hard on protecting each other. So when someone is struggling, find if possible some way to try to help reclaim their person. So the community doesn't just grow and dwindle, new people come and dwindle, and people leave, and then they're what? Who becomes your worst enemy? The worst enemy is not the atheist, it's not impersonalist, worst enemy to those who've been with us will become disgruntled. Nobody creates more problems than those who feel they've been cheated, they've been exploited, who have serious issues. In some cases, it's just distinctly their own fault. In other cases, it's a combination. In so many cases, it can be due to some weakness of heart, some weakness in one's own spiritual life. But if the environment somehow adds to the issue of disturbance, then the person can become very disturbed, even enemy of the society. We're having that from time to time. Greatest disturbances from our unruly cooler children, from lawsuits in some cases, from those who, for various reasons, have become vivid, have gone to this group or that group. And it's very, of course, complex. In some cases, people are looking for an easy ride, which they can never get. In some cases, they're looking for how to have Christian consciousness without accountability. They want an experience that they don't have to have to the president, GBC. And they want a chance where they can have a chance, have opportunity to enjoy without to be accountable. In other cases, the majority is not that. The majority is due to genuine issues in the society that they've overreacted to. If somebody overreacts, yes, the problem is theirs, but there's something that they have reacted, there's something that has been there that's caused them to be excessive. So, here, this Brahmachari, you know, he wasn't rich. I mean, he hadn't fallen down, but his mindset was becoming unhealthy. But he was attacked in such a heavy way that he felt that he had no place, you know, amongst the Vaishnavas. So he left and went to Maya. So now when they saw him in the back room, the Brahmacharis, they were like overwhelmed, and they were pleading for him. Please forgive us. We were excessive, we were too heavy in dealing with you. And please, accept our apologies. But then he was apologizing even more. Because he was saying, no, I was wrong. And I was always wanting, after I left, to come back. But I was too embarrassed. And I didn't even know whether I would be accepted. And so he was apologizing and so happy that somehow Krishna had answered his prayer. The devotee said, found him and come for him. So we know when people leave, they have all kinds of stuff. Sometimes they just have to work out something before they're able to say yes to Krishna in this lifetime, sometimes in another lifetime. But there are many cases where someone has in fact been at fault in some way, but is so much in need of family members to reach out and to try to let them know that they've been forgiven, or to try to help them to reinstate themselves. Because just in any institution that keeps losing people after they're trained, it doesn't have a very, very powerful future on a grand scale. You can't just keep creating and they're trained. It's like, you know, some countries, they have this brain drain. I'm just visiting Fiji and a few other places. So they have such a brain drain. People want to leave it. So many countries alike. So one of the ways they try to minimize it is that when somebody is given scholarship or trained, they get the person to make some commitment to work so many years in the government service, etc., etc. Or some businesses, when they train someone, they send them to school, they provide for them. But there's also in the contract that they have a responsibility to maintain in that company for such and such a time. They may leave later, but they try all kinds of ways to keep what they have. Some of you may have read, you know, one or two of my leadership books. And I explain and do some analysis Because businesses are very much concerned of how to keep, you know, their customers. Matter of fact, with the massive competition now, globalization of markets, centralization of technologies, sometimes success or the leverage, competitive edge, often has to do with training and keeping and having good teamship. Without the teamship, you can have facilities, you can have good vision and good plan, and it will fail. But it won't accelerate to a high level of excellence. And of having people who come, and now especially, you know, with knowledge workers, is a big problem worldwide of how we keep good young people. Because people don't have allegiance, because they go where they feel comfortable, and go there where they feel they can be creative, and where they have a career that they're comfortable with. So, what they've found in some of the business, international business schools, is that as they look at why people group, why they leave, why they go for the competition, why they give up their allegiance, why they choose another supplier instead of the one they used to have, and for us as devotees, why do they leave spiritually coming? So in general, they found out something like only something in the neighborhood of about 10 people leave, 10% of the people leave organizations. Because they find something distinctly better. About 15% of the people leave because they become, you know, dissatisfied with the product, with the workforce, some of them. But more like 75% of the people leave, in general, institutions, because they do not feel valued. That means people even sometimes work and get less pay. They will go to a restaurant that's farther away, endeavor, even pay sometimes a little more if they feel valued. If they don't feel valued, they vote with their feet. So the major reason we look at our community, any other body's community, people bloop, people go to this group, that group, major issue underlining all other things is an issue of not feeling valued. Somebody feels valued, some of their basic needs are met, then they have less and less reason to look for other alternatives. If people are finding that community stimulating, encouraging, and causing them to take to higher, more deeper involvement in spiritual life, they also have less reason to leave. So this afternoon, one of the things we'll be talking about is authentic community has a duty to see what are the needs of its people. There's different kind of needs that a brahmachari has than a householder. There's different kind of needs a householder who has 3 children in contrast to a householder who has no children. The different kind of needs that a person who is 60 or 70 years old needs, in contrast to a boy or a girl who is 17 or 18 years old. Then not only are there different kinds of needs that are there in the community with each person, but there are also different responsibilities and duties and obligations that each person can and is to offer based on their unique positions. So in helping the community, we need to look close at our devotees, whether they're in the temple or our congregation. They all have different particular needs. And we didn't say wants, because this want stuff is maya, and it's just can be sense advocate. But there are particular things that each individual needs to enhance his or her Krishna consciousness, the genuine. Sometimes our movement has suffered because we try to lump everybody in, so to speak. We miss that people have just different tendencies, idiosyncratic tendencies and propensities. Someone has more of a medical tendency. Someone has more vaisha. Someone has more shanti. Someone has more super. And these are genuine characteristics, qualities, ways of work, ways of processing. And because of such, there is, in order for that person to go on in his or her spiritual life, if their basic genuine needs are not being addressed, it's only a matter of time for the person blues. It's only a matter of time before they try to have some of those needs met in an unhealthy way. And so while we see this turnover happening so much, people come, then they go, and they come and go, and sometimes they come and they go and they go. And we lose so much. In I like to relate in terms of business terms, because everything runs is like business. It takes about 5-6 times as much energy and resources to bring a new recruit and make a new person than to keep an old person. So when we lose somebody, we're losing lots of resources, a whole lot of time for training, a lot to happen in trying to organize Food for Life, restaurants, preaching, temples, all kinds of ratiyatras and campaigns to make devotees, and then devotee goes. So we lose a lot of resources and time. And if the person goes and they're disgruntled, they then become the worst negative propaganda you can imagine. Because they have been with us, and people are likely to believe whatever they say, even though sometimes they're fabricating or they're justifying their own weakness, hiding behind it. But when they go out and they say, yeah, the Christian people are like this, or this is happening, then there are people who could come close to us, who could involve themselves in different ways, and in many cases, because they've been approached by someone who for them seems legitimate, they're paranoid, or they turn against us. We are what? Hubba said that ISKCON is a society, is a cultural society for re-spiritualizing the world. He didn't say that we are a religion. He didn't say that we're a social group. He didn't say that we are people who have this high philosophy, but we are actually having a culture that is to help the re-spiritualize. Now, if we analyze that, he's letting us know that we have something that we're supposed to be doing so effectively that it's supposed to have influence on the whole world. We are supposed to be the people who are having the transcendental and the spiritual perspective on everything. On parenting, on education, on relationship, on the ecology, on the people from one thing to the next. Because if you take like the mode of the Goswamis, they were distinct Bhakta sadhus. But they were facilitating all kinds of people, all kinds of situations. Sadhus, nice exchange with each other, with others, the royalty, the elite class, as well as the common folk. And it said that they were Samaham Sarabhutesu, equal and kind to all. So that means they were relevant. While they were fixed in their devotion, they were relevant to the issues of the day, relevant to the needs, relevant to the concerns of the people, and being able to offer some help in all cases. It wasn't that they were trying to convert everybody on the spot. They were more than ready to bring anybody into fully absorbed in the Vaishnava community. But they were the Vaishnava Brahmins, advisors, caretakers, and so they help people promote ignorance, compassion, goodness. They help people to be able to become more human, to follow Dharma, so they can later embrace Sanatana Dharma. Some cases, direct Sanatana Dharma, some cases. So if we hear that they were assistants to all of these kind of people, it means that they also had some association. To keep in mind, the Goswamis, we look particularly at Sanatana and Rupa, they were in the government. They left government now to spread a very powerful mission. It means that they were also sensitive to basic concerns, society. They want people who could not do anything, and therefore they are saying yes to Krishna. They were not people who were just waiting for Krishna to make something happen. They were fully devoted, and they strategized in creating spiritual community. And this is one of the most wonderful aspects of what Prabhupada has given this world. He arranged to bring the best of the East and the best of the West. Sometimes people used to challenge Prabhupada. If you are sadhu, then why are you using watch? Why are you driving this kind of car? Why are you using microphones? Why are you using all these things? Why not? If you're a sadhu, you're concerned about people, why are you building this grand and famous and glorious Bombay Juhu temple? Why are you spending all this time and building this elaborate mandir in Vrindavan? Why don't you just feed the poor? Why don't you just live in huts? But at the same time, as a preacher concerned about people's needs and understanding their consciousness, he knew, yes, if we lived in huts, then who would come? Very special people, yes, rare people. Most people would. But then we have the elaborate Juhu temple, for instance, where we have the restaurant and facilitation, the drama, a theater, and we have the guest house, hotel, so many things, and the beautiful deities. Then people want to be a part, and they come in the tens of thousands. So we look at what it needs as we try to create community. Let me give one another story. Once there was the Rajasuya sacrifice that Yudhisthira put together. And this was extremely elaborate, huh? And he had invited so many people. And they had spent so much expense and went all out. The Rajasuya ceremonies were very, very elaborate. Now, part of the ceremony that at the end of the yajna, and I shared it with the boys at the farm yesterday when I was here, there was a sacrificial bell in the center of the arena, and the sign that the yajna was complete and successful, that the bell was to ring on its own. It's like in Vedic times, when the Brahmin, the priest, would start the yajna, that often he would have to start the yajna by mantra, light the fire by mantra. And so, if he could not light the fire by mantra, everyone would realize, oh, cheater, deviant, not potent, get up. Next one. They would make sure that the ceremony would be auspicious, that one was walking their talk, their life. So, a sign of auspiciousness was that the bell was to ring. So what happened? Great personalities had come, and even Krishna himself had actually come to the yajna. And everything was done, but the bell, it didn't ring. Yudhisthira was in total anxiety. Not only was he so eager to have this auspicious occasion happen, but he realized something so elaborate and something of all these rituals, if it's done the wrong way, it can have negative, it can have negative effects. It'd be almost like a curse. And so he was like, really? Well, Krishna, what happened? Krishna said, something was missed. Although you served out so much, you had so much ritual, you invited all these people, did all the mantras, everything, that a simple, pure Vaishnava Brahman was not invited to the yajna. And so Arjuna had an idea of where such a pure Brahmin was, where he could be found. And he went to this village and begged this very Pakka Brahmin, simple but very, very pure, to please come and to attend ceremony and to be fed. Because this Brahmin had to be appreciated, welcome, honored, and offered the prasad. So, Krishna, Arjuna begged this Brahmana to please come. He wasn't into it. He wasn't into this big festive kind of activity. It was very simple. A very simple bhajan. But because they told him that Krishna was also there in attendance, he decided to come to have darshan of Krishna. So he came, and when he came, Draupadi, she prepared this elaborate feast for him and put it before him. So the Brahmana, being rather simple, very much into controlling his senses, brushing his tongue, he had this habit that he would just roll his sleeve up and he would just mix all of the offers out of them together. So you know, sometimes Mataji's cooked so wonderfully, so colorfully, and the taste is wonderful, and sometimes things just look so nicely. You just want to look at it, enjoy it with the eyes, enjoy it with the tongue and stomach. And to do so much time in making a beautiful feast, somebody just mix it all together. Everything is an art, the spices, the color, everything. And so he did like that. And he ate. But now after he finished eating, everything was finished with the ceremony. But the bell still did not ring. Now Yudhisthira was really fried. He was embarrassed. He was humiliated. And he saw this as totally inauspicious for his king. The opposite was happening that he expected. So again he asked Krishna, the veil did not ring. Krishna, what do we do? What happened? Krishna said, somebody made an offense to this Brahmin. And so the Pandavas, they were looking around, they were offense. He brought him here nicely, honored him. Fed him, probably better meal, best meal he ever had in maybe his whole life. But Draupadi was holding her head in. And they understood that something had happened. Something had happened, you know, they were Draupadi. And they all looked at her. She said, yes, she was offended. And when she saw this Brahmin, just mix all her personas all together like that. And he liked that. He was thinking, this uncouth gentleman. No culture. This is a Brahmin. Go back to the bush in the woods. And so, Krishna said, you have to invite him back. Like yesterday, we were talking about the offense, and that's to forgive him for the offense. You have to invite him. You have to execute this part of the yoga in the proper way. So Arjuna went back to the hut to see the Brahmin and invited him to come again. He said, no, there's no need. He saw his Lord, he was totally satisfied. He had his meal, he was totally satisfied. He had so much of his writing to do, his puja, living alone, very simply. Very, very deep, you know, in the eternal life. But Arjuna really begged him. Okay, he said it. So this time, Draupadi, he prepared an even more elaborate feast, even more colorful. And, just as the Brahmin's habit was, it was all there in front of him, and he just mixed it all together again. And he started eating. And after he took this one bite, then the bell started ringing. And the second Shabbat started ringing. Because everything have been done. So these little short stories just give a little emphasis on how each person is important. The university had so much elaborate arrangements. They were all in place. But as far as Krishna was concerned, that it was most significant as well, while dealing with the many and dealing with this big arrangement for auspiciousness, that a major key would be noticed, is that the proper care of each person, even a seemingly unimportant Brahman. Of course, it was simple, but quite pure. In the case of the story of Bhakti, you know, Bhakti Siddhanta with the temple, the disciples, that he was reminding us that we are really together because we're trying to work on consciousness. We're really together to try to protect each other. We're really together to be able to be there for each other when we get some weakness or begin to start going astray. We're really there because we have a duty to try our best, try to reclaim someone if possible. Or at least let them know that it is possible for them to come back as they come back based on the standard of what the community is. As we'll discuss later this morning, is that community is not just a matter of what. As we say, Prabhupada created a house that everybody could live in. You know, a house. And a house is structured. You got a kitchen, you got a bathroom, you got different distinct things, and that's part of the house. So Prabhupada created a house, but he didn't create a circus. He didn't create an environment where everybody could do whatever they want, call it Krishna conscious. The opposite. Prabhupada's mood was to be merciful and to tolerate. But where tolerating interferes with the serious devotees pursuing their Krishna consciousness, or where it interferes with the serious standard, then toleration at that point becomes a disturbance rather than something that assists the individual in the community. Somebody's weak, somebody's bewildered, we have a duty to try to reach out and tolerate. But if their actions become such a disturbance, then it becomes unfair to keep such people around, because then it's not protecting the people, or it's not protecting those who are genuinely trying to surrender and dedicate themselves. We use as a barometer, we tolerate them. But to the extent that their presence becomes a disturbance to the bhakti, or it takes away from the community to that extent, then tolerating becomes sentimental, because it reinforces the deviant person's activities, and it begins to, again, becomes contagious, and say, yesterday, it can affect others. So for that person's well-being, we are thinking, no, do not tolerate. Whatever our decisions are, should be what is for the greatest well-being of that person and others. Two, what is the greatest expression thing we can do that helps to facilitate spiritual community as a family? And as a family, what happens? Family has differences. Even two twins, even two Siamese twins are different. But in a healthy family, there is arrangements so that each family member can fill a part of what is going on. And Bhagavad Gita was describing yesterday, is that for some people, a big issue is that they have no conception of what a healthy family is. For many of us, that's a genuine issue. Is that people from broken homes, or in the environment, they saw that it wasn't authentic in relationships. So it becomes hard for them to understand and appreciate what it means to have healthy spiritual family, when we don't really have so much of a clue of what that meant, you know, from a practical sense. But as we look at many issues from a family perspective, then we have a key of how to facilitate, how to resolve, based on that particular structure. So we just shared these things this morning. We looked at three things. Is that institutions are very powerful and are needed. They can assault us. They can disempower people. They can wound people. And they can destroy them because they are so powerful. Religion is so powerful, it can do all the same things. Or it can help people in the most amazing ways. We also talked about Vedic culture as being the most powerful culture on the planet. It's like the Vanashram Dharma. It is the culture that Krishna himself has recommended for trying to exist in the material world. But it is the most dangerous. Who is more dangerous? If you look at Krishna conscious history, who are the most dangerous persons? They are the Rakshasas. Who, what? The big demons are those who involve themselves in the Vedic cosmology but exploit it. Jarasandha was very powerful. He executed all kinds of yajnas and rituals just to become empowered for destruction. So this is another example of how the great power, the greatest self, happens from within. The greatest demons, those who have come close, or just like Prabhupada explains, many things you have to be careful for. It's not the Brahmanas, of course, the Mayavadis, the atheists, the cheating scientists, it's not the Brahmanas, the person, all these things. But the greatest fear is the one itself. Was on the Sahajiyas. Now, why is the Sahajiyas more of a dangerous threat than any other animals? The Sahajiyas is even more of a threat than the right-out atheists. The Sahajiyas is even more of a threat than the voice on the person. Because the Sahajiyas look so much like the real deal. Therefore, one becomes one puts the guards down, they become more receptive to such, and they can become more hurt. More confused, more abused. So that which is so powerful, if it's not used properly, can really threaten. Right now, we have hundreds of people in our society who are on medication because of bewilderment. We have people all around the world in our movement who committed suicide because they feel like a material failure and also like a spiritual failure. But they've come into community with some type of solace and somehow it just didn't happen and they feel useless. And that is very dangerous, very important. And we have many who have not physically committed suicide. They're committing so slow suicide by their lifestyles. They've gone back to drugs, even more than the previous, because now they know so much, but not acting upon it. And so they can't really enjoy in the material world, really, because now they know too much. They realize that they're sin. At the same time, they don't feel comfortable in the devotee community, because for some reason, they don't feel supported, or they feel too embarrassed, or they're deviant, and they don't know how to make an alternate state of change. And so, they're like ghosts. We don't fit in anywhere. We must all work like anything and try to exist in such a way that we, our own life, helps to minimize people leaving the society. Because, see, once you have been absorbed in the culture of bhakti, your life is never the same. Because now you've been able to be exposed to what real existence really is, what the purpose of life really is. Now, when you go back out, illicit sex, education, unhealthy eating, every time practically one engages in such sinful things, intelligence will beat you and beat you and beat you. And so it's a very unfortunate situation any of our family members to be in. We want to do whatever we can to minimize that. The people will remain fixed in humility. And when there is a weakness, they'll be able to reveal their mind to get help. So let's stop there. Maybe there's some questions anyone has?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned really, really relevant points. I'd like to ask you what advice you would have to give to guru colleagues who have maybe been hurt or abused or anything and have left the society for some years and have become disgusted with the material society and have come back and they're trying to tiptoe their way back into the program and regulated principles and that was my first question.
Let me take that first. That's a very important question. From a sociological perspective, to study anybody's community, this involving itself in an alternative lifestyle, a major barometer of success or failure is its fruits, is what is going on with its children. Because where a culture is being accepted and it's rich or strong, then what will be noticed is that the majority of the children will be born into it and later will accept it as their own. The majority of our children worldwide do not accept Krishna consciousness with enthusiasm, do not live by the principles they were born in, majority, to go around the world. This is a sign in itself that every project has got to look closer at how to create greater facilitation to protect and to stimulate and to genuinely be able to enthuse people to remain more loyal and more faithful. You know, you'll hear me. In America, that one of our greatest threats now and disturbances is our own children, you know, are suing our society. And we're going to lose some properties. We're already losing millions of dollars. And, which, of course, you know, some mistakes were made. And a lot of those children, though, were not abused, but are angry. A lot of those children are angry because they were put into gurukulas and they learned Sanskrit, they learned Madanga playing, they learned so many things related to so-called Vaishnava culture. But many of them feel they would not learn how to cope in the world. And many of those kids, they learn so much that they have no passion for anything other than drugs and illicit affairs and travel. Because we have told them that material life is an illusion. And to be successful in most professions, you have to have some passion. So we've taken away their passion to pursue a doctor, a career as a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, and then we've taken away their passion. And at the same time, they have very little passion for sitting and listening to a class with somebody speaking for an hour and a half. They have very little passion for really investing their full confidence in a society when they see that their parents are on welfare, on the dole. They have very little confidence in society when they see mother and father been divorced 3 or 4 times. And they're supposed to be excited and happy about what they see as the effects of what Krishna consciousness has produced. So many people. They see the different, you know, divisions of Vaishnavas. For them, in some cases, even more painful because they've grown up with this different Vaishnavas who now this camp, this camp, this camp, this camp. So it becomes very difficult. But at the same time, we have to realize that the early devotees were pioneers. And in establishing any community, pioneers take a lot of risk. They put a lot of things in place. Some things not always so strong at first. They make a lot of sacrifices. A few months back, I was in Russia, St. Petersburg, and they had these amazing castles and unusual buildings. And people come from all over the world, you know, to see these castles. And then one of the devotees, and then they had this huge bridge. And one of the devotees just mentioned, as we were driving through, he said, but what people don't see or know about in most cases is the hundreds of people who died in trying to build that bridge. What they don't see is the thousands of people whose lives were risked being able to build up this gorgeous palace in that way. So it's understood that in the pioneering there will be a lot of sacrifice. But the sacrifice should be so great that the product or the ultimate product is just full of heavy karmic, you know, fallout because of the sacrifice. One of the reasons we have so many problems in our society. Some years ago I was trying to figure out, you know, because I'm very social psychologically kind of minded. I like to study things in this respect. A couple of years ago I was trying to understand, why is it we have so many brilliant leaders, so powerful, and we have so much dysfunctionalism in our society, and even so much disturbance when we come together and see as leaders? It's very hard sometimes to pursue, you know, visionary projects, hard to come to, you know, certain resolutions. And I realized it's so obvious. Bhagavatam explains when Brahmins, women, children, elders, cows are not protected, all civilization suffers. So we have so many cases in our society where we've been short in these categories in offering facilitation and protection. And because of that, it's like a cloud that hangs over us and makes sometimes even things that could be seemingly simple somewhat complex. So as we address the issue of doing better care to women, better care to children, greater attention to the cows, to the elders, to the Brahmins, then a whole different kind of wave begin to, you know, take place in our society that will move us much more toward progression. So now the thing is, what about on the side of the kids? Well, the children should, as best as possible, first try to understand that yes, a lot of mistakes were made. Some of those were unconscious mistakes. Some of those mistakes were made because we were trying to maintain and propagate a movement. At some point, the oldest person in ISKCON, you know, is only 25 years old, other than Prabhupada. And so here you have young men and young women, 19, 20, 23, 24, trying to organize and maintain a multinational corporation. And in most cases, we hadn't managed anything in our lives. And so naturally, there's going to be a lot of mistakes. And if you analyze the initial start of the movement, that the early devotees were coming from rather wealthy backgrounds, the majority of them in America, who were very much anti almost everything. They considered life, excitement, reality to be anti-bureaucracy, anti-form, anti-structure, anti-criterion. And so, with so much a reaction to the material world, and now Prabhupada was trying to help us to become gentlemen and gentlewomen, and to honor the highest form, structure, etc. So then a lot of things are done in kind of a hippie-ish sort of whimsical way, because people were really trying to get away from stuff more than become something. And then some things are just a matter of maturation. The mistakes that little boy does when he's like 6 years old, we see it as, you know, just immaturity. What someone does at 12 makes the same mistake, we don't think it the same way. Somebody makes the same mistake at 20 years old, at 30 years old, we think this person's a rascal, a nonsense. So mistakes we may have made at 5 years old in the movement was 5 years old, the movement was 10 years old, yes, but should not be still going on, and the movement is in its 30s. So therefore we should become much more sensitive, mature, clear, thorough, comprehensive about so many things. So our children should somehow try to understand that yes, their parents were pioneers and made a lot of sacrifices. And some things were beyond out of their own control. Some issues with institutional problems. And now they should try to see how to create a better balance. We often sacrifice for the mission, forgetting that the mission was our own families, as much as anything else. We often, while trying to save the world, forget about giving the proper love and affection to our wife and husband, to our children. We often, while trying to engage in building up the big projects, getting the books out and the big temples, we weren't thinking about, in some cases, about the future. We weren't thinking that some years down the line, we're going to have children who are teenagers. We're going to have even grandkids. And we have to see how their needs are provided. And so all of these, you know, things are there as part of community development. And community goes through, you know, different stages. So we look for our children while pursuing some means for taking care of family, career, job, profession. At the same time, being able to keep loyal to their Christian conscience, vows, and commitments. So, in many ways, we have two extremes now. We have where the early devotees made sacrifices in some cases, were not practical as far as looking for future. And we have now majority of kids who are just pursuing some material involvements or whatnot. And in some cases, they are trying to pursue a career, but having trouble trying to maintain, you know, their spiritual commitments. So what we are noticing is that when many of our Gurukula children begin to have children themselves, then they begin to reclaim their Krishna consciousness, because they want their children to be exposed to spiritual life. And they want to be some type of example for their children. So many children around the world who did leave or were disgusted or whatever are now reclaiming, you know, the philosophy and the culture. But they're coming back with a powerful sensitivity. It's like sometimes some of the younger people who are joining now, sometimes they leave because they look at our society and think, we're out of step. We're archaic. They don't see that we're relevant. They see we talk about, you know, self-sufficiency, but we are doing this, and we talk about everyone's appreciated. We're not the body. We treat women as like second-class citizens. We talk about Krishna consciousness, sing and dance to be happy, and people are miserable. You know. So they look around and they say, I don't want to be a part of this. Let's see. And they go. But they understand and are able to genuinely be happier in our spiritual life with higher realizations, then we'll draw more people who want to stay, who want to be a part of what's happening. Any other question?
Maharaj, you know, we're trying to balance in a family life. At the same time, when we read, we're told that you can achieve Krishna only when you're absolutely pure, right? At one time you can do only one thing. So is it a gradual process that, you as of now, one takes care of the family nicely, does his sadhana well, takes care of other devotees and all that. But living in this material world, you cannot be absolutely pure when you have to do these things, right? So is it a gradual process that, when you sort of come of age, the purity will come, or in my mind this contradiction that when we read it says that you have to be absolutely pure when you do these things, but on the other hand, when you take care of the family, when the children go to private schools and things like that, it's not the purest form probably.
It's definitely not easy to maintain family, because a lot of responsibilities are there. As we said, there's different needs and different challenges. But there's also different challenges in living in the temple, or the community as a grihastha, or there's different challenges in being a brahmachari or a brahmacharini. Every different ashram has its own challenges. And in Kali Yuga, no ashram are we really doing everything expertly. And this is why we're particularly happy about the mercy of Lord Nityananda and Lord Chaitanya. So particularly in Kali Yuga, we're mainly candidates for Nisipipa Siddha. Is that we are to be loyal, do our best, and at the same time we get mercy. So Krishna knows the struggles that one has as a householder. We shouldn't think that, in order for me to become Krishna conscious, I have to get out of household life and then I can live a life of purity. No. As we are in household life and as we are organizing things in a Krishna-centered way, that is renunciation. And in many cases, it's even a greater renunciation. It's a greater renunciation sometimes to be in a situation and not to be overly attached, and just to be away from it. There are many, many yogis and sadhus, majority of them, who come from India and they fall down. They come from India and they come to the West, they go to Europe, they go to Australia, come to America, and they're overwhelmed because they have been trained up in the life of simplicity. They have not been exposed much to sense gratification, material culture, and surely to Western women, feminine energy. And the majority of them, when they leave after many, many years of austerity and renunciation and being in this ashram and this that, and then they have to be confronted with some of the things of modernity, majority of them get bewildered, they get drawn in. So just being away from something is not really a sign of strength. Greater strength is even, it can be around you, but you're not becoming a slave to it or giving into it. So the fact of being able to have children and wives and family and have jobs, and then to orientate your life so that there's the Krishna available for everybody to take shelter of Krishna in such a way, that is renunciation. We shouldn't think that my spiritual life, when I come to the temple, and everything else is secular. No, my children are also my service to Krishna. My wife, my husband is service to Krishna, and therefore I must relate to them in a way that Krishna, the owner, would be pleased. Otherwise what happens is that we minimize, as we said, the facilitation of our families, and we're thinking that being spiritual means that all of this is just a burden, and it's useless, and it's an interference. No, it may or may not be. For many of us, many people, this is your way to become Krishna conscious. Now we look at the examples of the great devotees, who mostly were in fact householders, how they engaged in their Krishna consciousness. Any last question?
In relationship to the first question, without seeming insensitive, according to our philosophy, the material world is a place where there's also conflicts of inequities, and it's an embarrassing situation for us all, and there's so many things happening. So can we also see that, you know, many of us also are becoming Krishna consciousness, we experience sort of broken families, and so many things, the things you were mentioning which happened in our own society. So can we also see that, you know, this is just the special feature of coming to this world and having our experience?
It's definitely a part of the package of having a material body. But what we have experienced before becoming devotees is what we also bring into community, you know, into society.
Maharaj, on that point, I just think that a lot of it was to do more with the fact that because we were supposed to be coming from the society where we were not, you know, just doing mundane things, we were not, and there was supposed to be a real community mm-hmm. and a lot of trust. Mm-hmm. And so, whereas, you know, if someone was abused by someone who was a stranger, it is a lot different to being abused by someone who is a member of your community and a friend of your family.
This is a very powerful point. You know, the greatest abuse is family, and the greater abuse is spiritual. Because some stranger abuses you, attacks you, robs you, molests you, that's an abuse, it's heavy. But someone who's your friend, someone who's your protector, someone who's supposed to be the God man, the God woman, abuses you, it's many times, you know, heavy in that sense. And because, you know, we can say, well, in Kali Yuga in general, there's problems. So what's the big deal about the fact that we have problems in our society? But people expect not to come into a spiritual society and experience the same thing they're experiencing in the secular world. And when it does happen, it's worse. And the example is, you know, the Catholic Church now. They're under the gun. They're losing millions of dollars. They're losing millions of people also. And someone can say, well, this molestation has been going on. It's going on in society. But the point is, yes, it is going on in secular society. It's going on in all different environments. But people don't expect to come into a spiritual environment and to find the same things happening. And then it's considered worse because the spiritual people are supposed to be honoring Dharma, ethical, and moral. You ready?
Just in response to that, the fact is whether it happens in regular society or it happens here, the fact is it happens. So, as loving members of the family, what are we going to do about it? Because our society is based on relationships, isn't it? So that's what, you know, Prabhupada didn't put one glance at us and we felt that he loved us and knew us. And so I just see it as a form of accompanying each other. Through this difficult journey, we all have compassion.
And that's why a major aspect of healthy community is protection. We look at needs, and then there's the element of protection. Now, Kali, you're always going to find some deviation. Doesn't matter. Wherever you go, it's going to be there. But that deviation should be really minimal. As a community is stronger, there's this way to protect. So when there is such deviation, it's automatically, it stands out, or it's not to get able to come so close. Yes,
Maharaj, I very much appreciate it. There's one element to me here. In my own personal experience, subjectively and objectively, inside that society, and if I look at my whole life, I see there's a, that it's kind of inherent in all that we're saying here to me. For one thing, I was present in Vrindavan. With hindsight, I know now, I was present in Vrindavan at the time when all of the abuse was going on.
I wasn't involved in Louisville. I was involved in management when the temple was sold. And I had relationships with some of the teachers and some of the students, and I didn't feel comfortable about the whole thing. I really couldn't put my finger on why. Until many years later, I had to confront something in myself, and that was the toxicity of shame. And I noticed the way those children were treated was they were made to feel very wretchedly ashamed of themselves. And in my own life, I can see how debilitating that is. Because I see there's a certain warp on that. There's a certain warp on our philosophy, the way it's actually delivered. I can remember when I first joined the devil, I was shamed. Because I was made to feel I was a fallen conditioned soul. Rather than be made to understand I am a pure spirit soul in a fallen condition. And that shame works healthily. We can become ashamed, we can be made to understand what you did there, that was a shameful thing to do. And then you can rectify that. But if I'm made to feel ashamed of myself, before I have any real knowledge of what I am, then I'm destined to a cycle of self-abuse and abuse of others. And it's a spiraling thing that goes not just from one situation to another in my lifetime, it becomes multi-generational. And I pass it on to my children, and they pass it on to theirs, even unconsciously. So we find situations in which you're supposed to be in some kind of loving relationship with somebody, but in the middle of it all, some gratuitous violence. And we don't know why. But at the core of it all, there is the, if I'm ashamed of myself, then I cannot live with and in myself. So I have to create some crazy false self. And I feel this is a problem which we brought with us because it's the basis of Judeo-Christian social training, is shame. And because at the center of that, there is no apathy. It's so important we see that the first lesson Krishna gives us, you know, it's not, the lesson is not that you are not the body, but that you are a pure spirit soul. And that's a message we see that Srila Prabhupada was delivered with the greatest sensitivity and love and respect. That wherever we see life, there is a pure spirit soul present in a conditioned state. But if we put the conditioning for purity, there's a very famous film, Brother Son, Sister Moon, about the life of St. Francis. And he took himself to Rome because the church actually came out against him for what he was doing in Assisi. He walked all the way to Rome, and just his personal presence drew the Pope down to him, yes, in a personal sense. And there's a line there, he says that too often in our pursuit of original sin, we forget original innocence.
This is wonderful. This is good in this morning's session, now. And it kind of summarizes some major themes that we're trying to share this morning. Is that our Vedic culture can be so powerful, but can also be abused. It can be very disempowering. So what happens is that if we address people in situations, this was a similar thing that happened in the story, you know, about Siddhanta in the Brahmachari. So this Brahmachari was, yes, he was not proper, but instead of the approach to show him that he was wrong and to encourage him and to inspire him, it was just such a heavy smash. And the person, you know, got lost. Or instead of creating a greater atmosphere to protect him initially, the focus was just on, you know, building the temple. And so relationships became a secondary thing. There was something that did happen, but then there was excessive reaction. If we are people who then begin to move with a mindset of low self-esteem, if we are repressing rather than really unfolding, then what happens? We have all of this lust and anxiety, and all of these things that we artificially pretend to be away from, we repress, and then it comes out in all kind of unhealthy ways. It comes out in sometimes abuse, spouse abuse, children abuse, etc. And abuse of ourselves. So you can very easily, you know, you take a small child and you tell the kid, oh, there you go again. You're a moron. You're an imbecile. You can't do anything right. You just instill low self-esteem in the child. The child starts thinking, I am an imbecile. I'm a moron. So it's okay for me to do something ridiculous because I am ridiculous. I just have to try not to get caught. But if you instill in the kid, you've done something wrong, you let the child know that you are hurt because you know the child's quality is above and beyond what he or she is now about, what they're doing. And so you are empowering the kid. You're recognizing and identifying that there's a deviation or there's a low substandard. But you're dealing with it in a way to be able to produce something higher rather than reinforcing something negative where you get people pretending and artificially aligning and then afraid even to reveal and to get help when they can get help because of the kind of subculture that's created. So this is the difference between authentic community and also pseudo-community. Pseudo-community is many people can live together, but it's not a real sense of community. And we'll talk about this morning, but why not? It's like every home or every house is not a home because people are together, but it's not a real family. So every grouping of people in a project is not really, you know, community. If you can't trust each other, if they're not having genuine association, where there is genuine caring, some other factors that we'll discuss. So anyway, if you think about what we discussed this morning so far, and it's and let's keep it after breakfast. So it's 9:20 now. What time do we come back together at 10:30? Okay. So we got about an hour and 10 minutes for breakfast and finish a few rounds. And then at 10:30 we'll discuss a few things. If I can have a flip chart, possibly. We have that would help. And if you can bring paper and pencil, if you have, you know, bring buckets. We'll take, you know, more questions later. It's time for the chart is divine grace. A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Sri Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Jai.